The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
You know, the last time CPI was as high as it was in June when it peaked, it took 20 years for the Fed to get the inflation genie back in the bottle. And I know we've heard it many times that core or super core has peaked, but food at home is still rising more than 11% year on year. I don't know that that's anything to cheer about. Transportation is still rising 14.5% year on year, which is right at the all-time highs for this indicator, which is what we saw back in 1980 and again what we saw in 1976. The only one that's really come off of these three is the energy. And on a year-over-year basis, when it peaked in the summer, was rising at 41% year on year. Now it's rising at a little bit over 8%. So these things are still going up at 33, 34% combined year on year. I don't think that's really anything to cheer about. And it would suggest to me that the inflation situation, while not as dire as it was in the summer of 2022, is still pretty darn restrictive.
When Jerome Powell took over the Fed, he was very clear on a couple of points. The first one was, an inflation like the 70s will never take place on my watch, is exactly what he said. And more importantly, when you talk about going back to the 80s and going back to Powell, Powell told us he was a student of the 70s, and that's why he would never allow what's happening to happen. All right, he's already lost that game. But he also said, we know how to defeat it. We will follow the Volcker game plan. And that's exactly what they're doing now. And to do that, of course, you know, that has to incorporate pain, a word that he has used so many times. I'm actually working on a piece today that will look at how many times he's used that word pain in terms of his, you know, speeches, in terms of his post-FOMC press conferences, and so on and so forth. Of course, that means economic pain. That means pain in the labor market. That means a recession. It's almost inevitable. I'll give you three things. When they're all together, have every time led to a recession. Food inflation at home, food at home inflation above 6% annualized. It hit a peak of 13. It's still 11, right? Yield curve inverted. Yield curve is inverted as much as it has been since the early 80s, okay? And the third thing is a dollar that is appreciated by 20% or more over a 12-month period. We just got that end of May of 2022. So inevitably, when you have those three things together, it's led to recession in 12 to 18 months, 100% of the time.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, stocks finished down this week with the NASDAQ down 3.33%, the Dow Industrial down 2.99%, and the S&P 500 down 2.67%. The 10-year Treasury yield is up another week, up to 3.95%, and the 2-year Treasury higher, up to 4.81%. Earnings and economic data were at the forefront of drivers that influenced stocks mainly down and yields higher as investors anticipate the Fed will hold rates higher for longer than expected. The probability of a half point hike in March has risen over the past month from 2.8% to 27% as of this Friday. Last week, I mentioned that non-voting Fed officials have been emphasizing the need still to be aggressive. St. Louis Fed Bullard said that the Fed should be at 5 3/8 before a pause from the current 4.5 to 4.75 target. He also said there is a strong chance they could beat inflation this year. The Fed minutes for the early February meeting were released this week as well. The minutes said substantially more evidence of progress across a broader range of prices would be required to be confident that inflation was on a sustained downward path. And mentioned a few participants wanted to raise rates by 50 basis points at the meeting. Finally, on Friday, the PCE inflation data, this is the key inflation data the Fed watches, showed an acceleration in January up to 4.7%. versus 4.6% in December. Real personal spending was up 1.1% month over month. Real disposable personal income was up 1.4% month to month. And the personal savings rate was revised higher from previously reported from 3.4% to 4.7%, a very big jump. A higher savings rate suggests that the consumer can keep spending, which stoked concerns over inflation. Stocks opened deeply in the red Friday morning off that report. Continuing the story on the economic front this week, the IHS preliminary manufacturing and service PMIs for February rose to 47.8 and right at that half mark at 50.5 respectively. Existing home sales for January came in at about 4 million units, seasonally adjusted annual rate, and the prior month was revised to 4.03 million. The data showed that sales are still pressured by high mortgage rates and showed a moderation in the median selling price. Later in the week, new home sales were at 670,000 units, seasonally adjusted annual rate, while the prior month was revised to 625,000. Prices were down 0.7% for the median home, the first decline since August of 2020. New home sales were up 7.2% in January, while still down 19.4% from a year ago. So a decent pickup, but still well below where they were a year ago. Consumer sentiment rose in February, according to the University of Michigan's report, to 67 from 66.4, so a small increment there. At the start of the week, earnings announcements from Home Depot and Walmart stoked concerns about the economy, heading from maybe a soft landing to potentially a hard one. While both companies beat earnings estimates, both guided future estimates lower. For the first time in several years, Home Depot's comparable sales declined year over year. Consumer transactions dropped 6% on the quarter and 3.4% over a year ago. The company also announced investing $1 billion in analyzed comp for its hourly workers to attract and retain talent, highlighting a tight labor market there. Walmart, other than the lower guidance, had a very strong report as far as earnings and revenue were concerned. Their comparison sales were up 8.3% following 8.2% in the previous quarter, which were both nicely higher than the second quarter of last year when they were around 6.5%. And they've been aggressive at keeping inventories low, ending the year last year flat year over year. But the weak guidance and dropping completely their comparison guidance, something they typically provide, concerned investors Tuesday. The reports from Home Depot and Walmart are likely to lower expectations for other retailers in the future. And we've got Target, which will report next week on Tuesday, which will be a key announcement to watch. One of the few positive catalysts this week was the earnings report from NVIDIA Thursday, which helped to fuel a mega cap and growth stock rally. We've heard about high inventory levels from Intel and a slowdown in IT spending and macroeconomic uncertainties, which have plagued the tech industry. But NVIDIA beat estimates and raised its guidance. Well, NVIDIA missed expectations on its data center segment coming off of a hot Q3 jump of around 30%. It nicely beat its gaming segment with revenues up 16%. The CEO announced it is preparing to launch cloud-based AI products, which it says it will offer as a service to enterprises so they can deploy large language models and other AI workflows with partnerships with Microsoft and Google to reach customers. In addition to the lower earnings reports from two major retailers, as I mentioned, this week marked the anniversary of the Ukraine-Russia war, with saber rattling on all sides. The most recent negative information came in the New York Times with an accusation from Secretary of State Blinken that China is considering lethal assistance to Russia versus only currently buying oil and food. China has the ammo manufacturing that Russia needs right now, among other technologies and chips used in advanced warfare. Secondly, Putin announced Russia will suspend its participation in the New START nuclear treaty. So at the heart of trading this week was concerns over the consumer, as laid out by the top retailer earnings reports from Walmart and Home Depot. We had updated inflation data in the core PCE data front, and a shifting attitude towards how long the Fed will continue to raise rates. Up next, John Roque, this week's guest technician.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the program is John Roque. And John, I'd like to start for our listeners, given the nature of the market, a recent prayer you wrote about in the newsletter. God, please give me the strength not to make any decisions right after economic data is released at 8:30 or at 9:30 a.m., right after stocks open for trading, or after an FOMC rate decision or public comments. Amen.
Thanks, Jim. It's always a pleasure to be with you. And thanks for using my updated version of the Serenity Prayer. I promise I'm not an apostate. I was just adding it on. I thought, you know, maybe a God in his beneficence would help me achieve that stated aim of to avoid making any decisions immediately after data is released.
Well, on a serious note, let's take a look at the markets, John. What's your take here?
So I think, Jim, the way I try to explain it in my notes is that I don't think that there's a big call to be made here with the S&P at the where it is presently. It was turned away from 4,200. I've been using that as resistance. I think a lot of folks have. I've called it, where Hakeem Olajuwon or Dikembe Mutombo get active blocking shots. And they did it again at the 4,200 level. And I think there's really no reason to be overly concerned until the S&P gets under 3,900. I know I'm using too fine a pencil here, too fine a point on a pencil, but under 3,900 would tell me, hey, pay attention, look over your shoulder. You don't want to get caught unawares, because I would suggest then that it's probably a pretty good idea that we would retest what were the lows from June and then again September and October. So I think under 3,900 would be more than an amber flashing light. It would just say, hey, don't get caught unawares here.
John, what about interest rates? We're seeing the 10-year rise, and I'm seeing something, gosh, I haven't seen in decades, and that's T-bill rates at 5%.
Amazing. I mean, truly, it's been quite a unique era. Jim, not only are rates rising here, as you said, but certainly they're rising in other locales. And I like to look at rates in industrialized nations because they tend to move homogeneously over time. And I think rates are going to become a problem for stocks. It's surprising to me, but I'm going to give you my coda to this as to why I think it hasn't happened yet. It's surprising to me in some respects that rates haven't presented more of an issue. And I'll give you a reason. I don't know if it's the reason why it hasn't happened. I think a reason might be is that algos and passive investing don't really care about rates. They don't know what it may mean. Those items can't anticipate, and certainly they're not historically aware. I think also the number of active managers is certainly smaller in terms of numbers than it has been over the prior cycles. Certainly going back to the last time relative to when we had rates this high. So I think there's a lot of folks who are managing money today who may not know what has preceded them. And also, I think, Jim, in addition, we've come a long way since the last time rates were this high, in that back then you were a money manager. You managed equities and you managed fixed income. And perhaps you had a component of that that might have been in precious metals, chiefly gold. Now you don't manage money. You manage equities. Equity managers manage equities. Bond managers manage bonds. And I think the twain doesn't meet. And I think perhaps that's another reason why equities have not viewed more seriously the rate rise.
You know, along those lines, it just strikes me about our own industry where it's really designed around passive investing. You come up with this mix, 60-40, 60 equities, 40 bonds. You put them in passive index funds. You just leave them there. And, you know, for decades, I mean, it might work. It worked in the last decade, probably not as much so in the previous decade, where we saw two giant bear markets within a short period of time.
It's true. And I pay attention to, I'll give you the symbol in case any of your listeners would like to pay attention to it. I pay attention to the AOR. That's the symbol. It's the iShares Core Growth Allocation ETF, 60%, as you said, Jim, in equities and 40% in bonds. So I tend to use this to perhaps give me some clues as to what the, let's say, that measure of the two asset classes are doing. And it's not that different from the S&P 500, really. It's really not that different. Or it's not that different from, let's say, many of the stocks that we look at daily. It bottomed in October, rallied into December, made a low into late December, early January, and then rallied again into very early February and has pulled back here. So the AOR equivalent for the S&P 500 at 3,900 might be at 4,750. So under 4,750 in AOR, I'd start to get a little bit concerned, because then it would look like it would get back to the lows of the autumn, which would be around the 45 area. But it's also difficult, Jim, based on this input as well.
You know, John, going back to your serenity prayer, where we diagnosed any kind of economic data coming out, and especially today with inflation, we get some kind of inflation number like producer prices higher than expected. Then you get a number on, let's say, CPI that came in as expected. The street seems to think, or at least they think, that at some point the Fed is going to pivot. What if they don't?
I wish I had a good answer for you. I don't. I've asked that same question myself. I know you and I have talked about this, but I'll just repeat it. You know, the last time CPI was as high as it was in June, when it peaked, you know, it took 20 years for the Fed to get the inflation genie back in the bottle. And I know we've heard it many times that core or super core has peaked. You know, okay, that's fine. But we really should be paying attention to food at home, energy, and transportation, because while these are volatile, we know that, they really do provide clues as to where the overall CPI will move, despite the fact that they've removed these items from the CPI. Now, as of the last count, and the numbers, of course, are through the January prints, food at home is still rising more than 11% year on year. I don't know that that's anything to cheer about. Transportation is still rising 14.5% year on year, which is right at the all-time highs for this indicator, which is what we saw back in 1980, and again what we saw in 1976. The only one that's really come off of these three is the energy. And on a year-over-year basis, when it peaked in the summer, was rising at 41% year-on-year. Now it's rising at a little bit over 8%. So I don't know, 25 and 8, these things are still going up at 33, 34% combined year-on-year. I don't think that's really anything to cheer about. And it would suggest to me that the inflation situation, while not as dire as it was in the summer of 2022, is still pretty darn restrictive.
Well, I just got a shock. I mean, we've seen nat gas prices drop, but in December, I got a nat gas bill, or in January for December, I got one for $7.30. When I got my January bill, it was $1,050 or something like that, close to it. And it's almost double from a year ago. I mean, and that's me. I just imagine what is happening across this state of California and elsewhere in this country.
It's funny you mentioned that. I just paid my heating oil bill. It was for, you know, a number close to what you said, and was certainly a double versus a year ago. So I would think that numbers like this would probably curtail economic activity in some other area, eating out, traveling, something. So it is a little strange to me that we keep kind of reinforcing each other's views by saying, oh, you know, restaurants are crowded. You know, I wonder if restaurants are still crowded, because thankfully people are working. That's tremendous. But maybe this could be just a lagging indicator, and maybe it happens later on in 2023 when it manifests itself.
And getting back to what we've seen in so much of investing today is passive. It goes into index funds, and you know, I just think of the amount of money going into 401ks each month. Most people that have 401ks, they don't change their allocation. So the money just keeps going in. At what point do you think, John, rates have to rise where it begins to choke economic activity? I mean, the GDP numbers are still up. They're on the positive side, although we got a couple negative prints last year. But at what point, or how high does it have to get, do you think, before things start to break?
I think it's a really important question. I just don't know. I have a fantastic contact in the business. We were colleagues way back in the late 90s. Sorry for giving you a signpost that far back, but we were colleagues, and he's an excellent market contact, and he is perhaps one of the best strategic thinkers that I've spoken with. You know, he's asked the same question, and he's posited, you know, with a small question mark on the end, if it's going to be kind of a serious sustained move above 4% that would likely wake folks up. I mean, the 10-year got above 4% briefly in October, and again briefly in November. But maybe we have to get above what was the high of that period of 4.34% to really wake people up. I do know that if you can get about 5%, as you mentioned earlier, on a short-dated T-bill, and your earnings yield on the NASDAQ is probably a little bit less than 5%. So it seems to me to be a pretty decent idea to try to buy some short-dated treasuries based on just comparing it to the earnings yield of the of NASDAQ.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be TINA. There was no alternatives. But when you start looking at 5% treasury bills, that's not a bad place to hide.
I happen to agree with you. I mean, I'm just going to put up the 3 month here just to give you an updated figure. The 3 month is paying you 3 months, 4.8%. I think that's pretty nice money over 3 months.
That's not bad at all. And it looks like in, what is it, the six is at five now, and the 1 year is at close to five. So, I mean, these are decent returns. And I would argue, John, are going to start offering some serious competition to stocks.
I think it's I think you present a cogent argument, and I think it's hard to compete with that. But again, and perhaps this is my failsafe, so your listeners should dismiss it if they'd like. I don't think that passive and algos really care where the 6 month T-bill yield is. I don't think they've been programmed to pay attention to that. I don't think so.
Well, John, let's move on to the commodities sector. We've seen energy peak last summer, and it's been steadily moving down. On the day we're speaking, we've got what? WTI in the $74 range. What's your take on energy short and long?
So I will say that I think I've gotten pretty lucky with it since June, when I've suggested to our clients that the price of oil was going to work lower. December 2023 futures contract peaked in June of 2022 at almost $94. It traded as low as 68, but as you said, it's 74 today. And it's below a downward sloping, slowly cresting, rolling, turning lower 200-day moving average. And my history suggests that I don't have very good luck going long items that behave like this. And so I think that this is likely to be continue to be difficult with the energy complex. So it's WTI in there. Of course, Brent is also in there, as well as heating oil, diesel, and gasoline. And I look at all of these items at the same time, because of course, they're all oil derivatives. And they're all in the same kind of downward biased channel since June. Negative momentum, lower highs the whole way. So I know most of the volume is in WTI. And I know that the fundamental inputs, at least as I hear them, because people who want to be long oil or who believe oil will rally sharply, believe that because they figure that China will reopen, economic activity will pick up, and they're all also banking on the restocking of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And so I kind of asked the wise guy question. If those are all the fundamental inputs and they're so good, how come oil's not already on the moon? That's, you know, I of course, I think we should know the answer to that question because everybody's already long and all those items have been well discounted. It reminds me a little bit of what we heard in the autumn of 2021 about semiconductor shortages. And I kept asking at that point, if this is true about semiconductor shortages, how come semiconductor stocks aren't on the moon? And I think that was also well discounted at that point. And so I just want to keep asking the question, how come these things act so poorly if the fundamental inputs are supposed to be so bullish?
Well, let's go to another anomaly, and that's precious metals. If you would have asked me what kind of environment metals would do well, high inflation, we just talked about double-digit inflation for basic cost of goods from food to transportation, utilities. We've got geopolitical conflicts. We've got a proxy war. A lot of uncertainty in the market, all the things that you would think that metals would do well, but they haven't.
It certainly is a conundrum. I thought particularly, and I know you're going there, so I'm going to take the ball and run with it. You know, gold, when it started to rally in November, I said, if it gets above 1700, I think it's going to have a really good shot to get back toward the old highs, which occurred early last year. And then it got to over 1900, and I said, oh, this is acting pretty darn well. And now, of course, it's pulled back from, you know, it was mid-1900s to about 1820. I think gold is trying to find some support here as its decline is slowing. And I think part of the issue that gold has pulled back so sharply is because the dollar rallied, you know, from what was its recent low in early February to where it is here. So it was on the DXY, it was almost 100, and here it is now, almost 105. But I think the dollar is not going to continue its rally. And I think when the dollar corrects, we'll probably get a better bid or better action out of precious, particularly gold.
So given this nature, you and I have talked about, there is serious competition to equities now, especially with T-bills. I mean, we're almost 40% invested in short-term T-bills and corporate debt getting 5 to 7%. I mean, that is almost anywhere from three quarters of the return of long-term stocks. What would you be doing here as an investor?
I still think it's right not to be especially aggressive. And Jim, I'm of the mindset that I want to get aggressive when breakouts work. And I don't really think that breakouts are working here. Certainly, they didn't work at all last year, except in some, you know, kind of off instances where you got some to work, but generally they're not working. And so I feel I want to be aggressive when breakouts work and there are big bases and the number of new highs on the New York Stock Exchange are advancing and the number of new lows on the New York Stock Exchange stay low and do not advance. But those inputs aren't occurring here. So I don't think this is the right time to be especially aggressive with equities. Now, I know we might hear the contrary to that. Someone will say, well, when it's not time to buy equities is when you want to buy equities. And I don't think I've heard that it's not the right time. Even all through last year, people had not given up on equities. So I think this is a strange environment. I don't think we got the capitulative, I swear off equities, I'm never going to be in them again kind of scenario, despite the fact that the market did poorly. And I think for my own money, I would need to see breakouts work and new highs start to advance relative to new lows. And that's not really happening.
In the meantime, you have some good alternatives if you're looking for something to do. As we mentioned, T-bill rates are in the 5% range. Short-term corporates can get up to 7. Not a bad place to hide. Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow you or maybe have some prayer time with your serenity prayer, how can they do so?
Okay, so I have a Twitter account. It's called @DA Chart Life. I went to school in the Bronx, so maybe that's the reason I chose duh. And then, of course, I'm at 22V Research. And if there are any institutional accounts or any RIAs that want to speak with me, please don't hesitate to contact me via the website.
Oh, you put out some fabulous stuff. I always enjoy reading it.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
All right, John. Well, listen, you take care, my friend, and we'll talk to you again.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the best thing you can say about 2023, at least the stock market is still in positive territory. Hasn't done much of anything. If you take a look at the last 6 to 8 months, we've been in a 400 to 500 point trading range. Let's find out where we're heading. Joining us on the program from Weldon Live is Greg Weldon. You know, Greg, there's a lot of talk in the markets now. The Fed may have to go longer, may have to raise the Fed funds rate higher than Wall Street's expecting. And there's this talk about inflation. And I just want to throw out some numbers here. I was looking at some charts on a Bloomberg, and from 2019 to March of 2022, the M2 money supply was up 51%. During that same period of time, the Fed's balance sheet was up 120%. And also during that same time, the national debt grew by $9.5 trillion, up 43%. And we're asking and scratching ourselves, why do we have inflation?
I think the one stat you might want to tack on to the end of that great description that you just gave us is the decline in individual income tax that's all of a sudden materializing. When you talk about the government's debt, when you talk about servicing that debt, when revenues are declining in one of the tightest labor markets ever, we actually have nominally, at least, wage gains, which, of course, evaporate the second you get your paycheck. That's a real recipe for disaster. And it really, if you want to address this from the very top down, you have to go all the way back to the 1980s. Because when Jerome Powell took over the Fed, he was very clear on a couple of points. The first one was, an inflation like the 70s will never take place on my watch, is exactly what he said. Okay. Thank you for playing. Okay. We have a nice parting gift for you. That's already gone. I mean, this whole transitory thing, which most of us that, you know, had half a brain knew was ridiculous. The word was the exact wrong word to use. Inflation was not transitory. Inflation is real because of all the things you just said. And more importantly, when you talk about going back to the 80s and going back to Powell, Powell told us he was a student of the 70s, and that's why he would never allow what's happening to happen. All right. He's already lost that game. But he also said, we know how to defeat it. We will follow the Volcker game plan. And that's exactly what they're doing now. And to do that, of course, you know, that has to incorporate pain, quote unquote, a word that he has used so many times. I'm actually working on a piece today for the Melvin Live client that will look at how many times he's used that word pain in terms of his, you know, speeches, in terms of his post-FOMC press conferences, and so on and so forth. Of course, that means economic pain. That means pain in the labor market. That means a recession. It's almost inevitable. I'll give you three things that, when they're all together, have every time led to a recession. Food inflation at home, food at home inflation above 6% annualized. It hit a peak of 13. It's still 11, right? Yield curve inverted. The yield curve is inverted as much as it has been since the early 80s, okay? And the third thing is a dollar that is appreciated by 20% or more over a 12-month period. We just got that, ended May of 2022. So inevitably, when you have those three things together, it's led to recession in 12 to 18 months, 100% of the time. The Fed's goal here, if you take them at their word, is to create a recession to dampen demand to the point where inflation will come down. Now, inflation is going to come down anyway. It's a base effect dynamic that's about to kick in February, March, April, May. That's going to be significant in energy. So you will have the appearance of less inflation, which may allow the Fed to kind of take their foot off the brake here. But the point here is a draconian series of rate hikes mimicking what Paul Volcker did, you know, and certainly the degrees you had higher inflation then. So, of course, interest rates were higher, but it's a relative gain and it's very similar in that sense. Well, Volcker got away with it because of all the things you just said, Jim, that you didn't have the debt in the 1980s that you have now. Not only the government, the consumer. Corporation globally. I mean, the amount of dollar debt out there is highest ever, of course, by far. We know that. Causing a recession when you have that kind of debt background is a dangerous game, Jim. And I just did a speech, international speech, where I used the picture of Nick Walenda, okay, crossing that Niagara Falls on the tightrope using the balance beam. I mean, that's Jerome Powell right now. You go too easy, too quickly, or not tight enough, long enough, and you tip one way. You go too hard, too fast, too long in tightening, you tip the other way. It's almost a lose-lose proposition. And I think when you whittle all of this down, it stands out as one thing that the Fed has yet to see that will cause them to maybe take their foot off the brake. And that is pain in the markets, Jim. You know, it's so polarized because even my opinion is polarized. You don't really want to cause a recession with all this debt. On the other hand, you know, you look at the situation now, can you really justify kind of reflating with the gold just shy of $2,000 and near record highs, the stock market just shy of record highs? You reflate from here and the inflation will be out of control the next time around. And it's inevitable that you will see, excuse me, a higher low in inflation here because you're talking about a 40-year trend that is reversed. So I wouldn't envy the Fed's job for anybody. You couldn't pay me enough money to do what they're doing. But I would say that if the Fed were an NBA team, every member would have been benched, waived, or sent down to the D League by now because they've done a horrible job.
Well, Greg, let's talk about where we're going with this because I'm looking at a matrix of treasury yields. We've got 6-month and 1-year treasuries over 5. We've got the 10-year heading close to 4. You've had 12 consecutive months of the housing market declining. How much more pain, or let me ask this, how much more do they raise before they create some kind of credit event?
Well, I mean, it's almost like they're going to before they get there because it's inevitable. I mean, I'm not going to say it's inevitable, but it seems that way. And I think that, again, what needs to happen is you need disinflation in the markets and you don't have it. So can you reflate with the stock market and the record highs? Can you reflate and have credibility with gold just shy of $2,000 an ounce of near record highs? I think that's a tough pill for a central banker to swallow, even if it's the right medicine to take here. Because you know, and I know, Jim, that what kind of the path here has already been laid out for us over the last 40 years. You can't reverse it on a dime and expect that things are going to be different in the future. We have chosen our path. Okay, 2007, 2008, 2009, we made the choice. I can even take you back to 1990 when Alan Greenspan, then Fed chairman, took interest rates to 3%, down to 3%. And it was caused a big cacophony of criticism. Why? Because inflation was 3%. It was the first ever zero real interest rates. And everyone went nuts, right? And that was how we kind of got out of a recession that might have been to get us to pay down some debt where we could have had some organic growth from there. We didn't do that. Alan Greenspan kind of brought us to ZERP on a real basis. And not we could take it back to that. And certainly 2008, 2009, QE, the introduction of QE, which I talked about in my book in 2006. And I said they will print money and devalue the dollar as a means to avoiding a consumer collapse amid a housing market debt crisis. And that was considered heresy back then. The Fed will never monetize government debt. And they sure as hell have. You're talking, you know, over $30 trillion in nominal debt, a balance sheet of $8 trillion. Question is, how much can they shrink their balance sheet this time without precipitating a whole nother disaster like you just said? And again, it's Nick Wallenda trying to cross Niagara Falls here. It's a very difficult task, and I think it's almost inevitable that Powell's going to fall off the high wire somewhere along the way.
Hey, Greg, how much of the stimulus, as I pointed out, in the last 3 years, the deficit has gone up by $9.5 trillion. I mean, I think the Biden administration passed $7.5 trillion of new spending. How much of that is being pumped into the economy and is keeping it up where it is today? Because you subtract that $9.5 trillion, I'd hate to see where the economy would be.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, we have artificially held things up, you know, going all the way back to forbearance. And what are you seeing now? You're seeing shelter inflation take the lead. Something that anyone, again, with half a brain could have predicted like we did a year and a half ago. I mean, you and I talked about this, that rent was not going up because of all the forbearance. And now you have a situation where, yeah, they have absolutely crushed the housing market. I mean, the problem is, you know, the next time around, you're going to have even lower supply because what's happening is starts and permits are breaking down. All right. You already have existing home sales are down enough to where they are threatening the 50-year uptrend line going back to the 1970s, Jim. I mean, this is really major league, top of the line macro stuff that we're talking about. So when you have the next flip, you don't have enough homes. This is still a supply demand imbalance that is not going to go away. And during the next reflation, you're going to see a situation in housing where home prices are even more expensive and where more people are even priced out of the housing market. So it comes down to a lower standard of living. All right. You're talking about, you know, and I know we've talked about this as well off air, that when you have this kind of inflation, you're affecting about 2/3 of the population at the lower half of the income scale that just can't make ends meet. All right. Savings have basically kind of disappeared for all intents and purposes. Wage gains are vaporized the second you go to the bank with your paycheck. And we know that people have borrowed money at record pace, record levels, record expansion of consumer debt, just to pay the bills. So thinking that this situation comes without pain, that makes even the Fed shudder, I just don't see how it happens. You know, the bigger question is, how do we deal with this in the market? And that's an even more complicated question to answer, but it's always fun to try.
You know, it's really interesting, Greg, because, you know, we talk about inflation and the way the government massages the inflation numbers, they make them look lower when it's actually higher. I mean, I just got in California a natural gas bill for $1,030. And we don't even keep our heat up high, Greg. That's up over 100% from where it was a year ago. So if my bill's up like that, I was going to get a Generac natural gas generator. But given natural gas prices, I'm going to have to go look at maybe Tesla batteries. But imagine what what about the average person out there that is dealing with utilities, we're dealing with food, dealing with gas, dealing with premiums on insurance, medical costs. Everywhere you look, everything is going up.
Everything, Jim. I mean, it's like, think about, you know, commuters. And that's it's kind of a double-edged sword when we start to talk about commuting in places like New York City, right? And revenue from businesses that is plunging because no one goes to work anymore and nobody wants to live in New York anymore after all the, you know, harebrained policies they put in place there. But when you get back to what you're saying, the consumer chokes. A consumer cocoon is what I call it. It's already evident and it will harden as we go forward. And I think that this is part of the reason Fed is really so passionate now, if you will, about eradicating inflation through lowering demand. But it's like, be careful what you wish for. You just might get it. And I think that that doesn't serve, you know, most of the people the best. I mean, it really is a difficult question. I mean, there's no real easy answers here. I don't pretend to have answers because we chose our path. We're on this path now. It is ever higher inflation, to be ever higher interest rates, as we have a lower standard of living. And keeping pace with that as an investor is going to be very difficult because you can buy stocks and hold them, and that's great. But the Argentinian Merval makes a new high every year. Well, do you think that standard of living in Argentina has gotten better over the last 10 years? No. Why? Because they chose currency depreciation as a means to stimulate. Every country in the world is in this situation, Jim. The U.S. isn't even as bad off as other places where food inflation, you take Eastern Europe or places in Asia, where food inflation had been as high as 30 to 35% a year. The per capita income is way lower than in the U.S. You talk about a global recession here, not just in the U.S. We're very U.S.-centric here, but you know me, I follow pretty much every, you know, free country in the world. And I can tell you, when you look at Eastern Europe and you look at already what a tenuous geopolitical situation you have there, and you have a consumer that is absolutely choked on inflation to where just paying the bills become extremely difficult and standard of living is just plummeting. And I think that that's sad. You know, again, the answers are few and far between. So that makes it a really difficult situation to try and handicap because I can be critical all I want, but there's no answers. The answer is we continue down the path we've already laid out for us because it's the only way we cannot reverse now without bringing on a global economic depression.
You know, this brings up a question because if the Fed gets its way and takes the U.S. economy into recession, what does that imply? It implies less tax revenues, so the deficit gets bigger, and also more people out of work, business profits drop, so there's less corporate taxes. What do they do to restart the economy? And I'm talking about, you know, they just spent and increased the debt by $9.5 trillion in 3 years. The money supply is up 43%, and the Fed's balance sheet is up 120%. What do they do to get us out?
They can only do more of the same, Jim. You know that. I mean, and that's the problem. Because more of the same, you know, also leads us to a really bad place down the road. And I hate to be gloom and doom. I'm a very positive, you know, high vibration type of guy when it comes to life. But when it comes to the economy and the markets and, you know, politicians and central bankers, there's really not much to be optimistic about. Again, you have a situation where how do you restart the economy? You buy more debt. You print more money. That's why you want to own gold. Because even though it hasn't made new highs in dollars, it's made new highs against almost every other currency in the world. And the way to go here is basically what I wrote in the book again. I hate to kind of pump my own backside here, but when you talk about 2006 book I wrote, one of the things I said is the ultimate game is monetary Armageddon. And what that means is I picture the two guys. It's like the movie with the nukes, and they have the two guys in the bunker in Wyoming somewhere, and the general and the chief of staff or whoever they are got to turn the keys at the same time to unlock the nukes. I see the Treasury and the Fed in the bunker using the keys to print enough money to buy every dollar of debt the U.S. government has ever printed. Problem is, you want to own gold then because loaf of bread will cost you $50, and most people will be poor.
You know, why do you think, Greg, if you look at where we are today, highest inflation in four decades, you see it everywhere. You've got geopolitical turmoil, the war in Ukraine. And the day you and I are talking, Putin delivered a very harsh message about war. You've got China is going to visit Russia, maybe team up with Russia and help them. So all of these factors with inflation and everything else would spell well for gold. Gold has held a tight range, but it hasn't really lifted off. It got up to a little over 1,000, I think it was last March, but then pulled back. What do you think is going on with gold here?
Well, I'll say two different things. First of all, gold has done very well in a period where the dollar was up 20%. So people always ask me, Greg, why is gold so bad? It's like, what are you talking about? I mean, gold has held its own while the dollar's up 20%. That's pretty dang good, all right, number one. You have to be patient because you need the dollar in play, and it's not in play yet, all right? So that's number one. Number two, you say maybe China is in cahoots with Russia? Maybe? We've had this conversation on your show before, Jim, all right? I have told you and your audience, the new axis of power is China, Russia, and OPEC. This goes back a long way, but I can trace it back to 2019 when China opened the Dubai priced futures on crude oil priced in renminbi in Shanghai. All right, the next step was to engage Russia. All right, they got Russia to agree to price their Urals crude benchmark off the Shanghai renminbi price. At the Olympics, Xi and Putin sat down and they crafted a 30 trillion renminbi natural resource deal, which included state bank loans from China in renminbi to Russia to build another pipeline, a second pipeline in Siberia that would come down to China. And they engaged Kazakhstan and created a deal to deliver natural gas from Russia to China through Kazakhstan. So when the Chinese had their plenary session just recently, their five-year forward planning, Xi came out. What's the number one priority for the Chinese Communist Party right now? It is food security. What is Ukraine got a plethora of, Jim? Food. This is all about food for China, the entire thing. You know, don't think that for a second that the invasion of Ukraine wasn't sanctioned by the Chinese. And now it's come to light that they're helping them. Wow. Shocker. Not to anyone who was paying attention. Follow the bouncing ball. And certainly when you tie this back to Biden, one of the first things he did was disrespect the younger faction of the House of Saud, all right, the Saudi Arabian royal family. Those are the guys, women, whatever, Saudi Arabia's guys, but that run Saudi Aramco, right? This is the first month of his presidency. And what did they do? They shifted their exports from going to the U.S. to going to China, right? So don't think that Saudi Arabia and OPEC is our friend here. They're not, right? And the fact that you have Joe Biden crawling to the Saudi royal family begging is actually just a disrespect to every American out there. You know, that this is the point we've come to. We could be energy independent. And people say we are. We are, but we're not, because we don't choose to be, because we still import OPEC crude every single month. And this is a problem. So, you know, how this plays out in terms of China is a big, big picture thing. And I think that, you know, if you look at Taiwan, is going to be the next stage. And what happens if they invade Taiwan? Well, Biden said we're going to respond, right? Well, Jim, there's one nuclear weapon that China has that we don't have. It's the U.S. dollar as the petrol currency. And this will happen eventually. You can mark my words. It may take some time, but think back to this and say, yeah, Greg Wilden said that a long time ago. The day when China, who imports and exports the most dollar volume of commodities or anything every single month, or over $300 billion a month importing and exporting, the day they say we'll only accept renminbi for our exports and we'll only pay renminbi for our imports is the day the dollar gets crushed. And this is the kind of thing, you know, it's like they invade Taiwan and all of a sudden the U.S. is up in arms and, you know, in the back doors, they say, look, you know, we're basically going to play the dollar card if you don't let us do what we want to do with Taiwan. And the U.S. will roll over like we always do now.
You know, it's interesting because you're seeing a movement by the BRIC countries plus. So more and more Latin American countries, resource countries are wanting to join in this coalition. It's kind of like an anti-dollar coalition. So as you look at this, Greg, as it unfolds and conditions in here worsen, how long before that day arrives where the dollar is crushed?
I don't know, Jim, but that's going to be a sad day. And the day you're going to want to own gold, because the dollar will really get whacked. It's almost like that day is the day China and Russia win. I mean, for all intents and purposes, because our economy will be in the proverbial SHI, so on and so forth. I mean, we'll be in down the drain economically, and you'll see what a lower standard of living vis-a-vis inflation is really all about. And that's just a day. I know I tell people now, Jim, it's the first time I ever said this. I'm old and decrepit, so I know I'm in my 60s, but it's the first time in my life I've been legitimately able to say, I'm glad I'm not 20.
Wow. You know, if you take a look at this too, because that's one thing the United States has enjoyed, we're able to export our inflation. We import goods denominated in dollars. Imagine the dollar falling and we have to pay for imported goods. I mean, this whole green movement, Greg, China dominates the green movement, whether it is solar panels, parts for wind turbines, rare earths, you know, their stockpile of every commodity from copper to cobalt to lithium. I mean, how is this going to work out?
Well, rare earths is a real sticking point, and glad you brought that up, because, you know, China controls roughly 88% of that market. Under Trump, the U.S. budgeted money for the exploration of rare earths. Now, what's funny about rare earths is they're not as rare as you might suggest. I mean, we can find it in the U.S. We just don't. So that's number one. But number two is the bigger picture things you're talking about here, because that is the forward look. Is a dollar that depreciates so much at a time when we are still, you know, importing so many of these, you know, natural resources that we need to run the economy, that, you know, it's going to be hell to pay, so to speak. As far as green energy, we've had this discussion on your show a few times. All right. I mean, is global warming, I mean, it's the biggest fraud ever perpetrated on the American public. The globe is warming. That's not the point. Okay. The globe is absolutely getting warmer. It's also record cold, record floods. It's record drought. It's record everything, Jim, and it's both sides of the spectrum. It's the ultimate polarization. It's taking place in weather, in politics, in human behavior. You see it everywhere. Polarization is a big thing in all of what's happening. And to say that the Earth is going through its environmental changes because people drive SUVs is ludicrous, Jim, because driving SUVs on planet Earth has nothing to do with why the ice shelves on Pluto are melting, which they are. NASA just went maybe 6-9 months ago. It's no longer even called global warming, Jim. It's now called solar warming, officially, according to the U.S. government, because that's what it is. And it has to do with all kinds of science that we could talk about for hours that I love talking about. But it has to do with where our solar system is in the Milky Way. It's a highly electrically charged place with a lot of light coming from a lot of different places that hit our ionosphere and warm up the planet. We're more electrically charged, we're warming, and you can see we're more polarized. And nowhere is that more evident than in politics and human behavior. So it's, again, it's one of those things where I'm glad I'm not 20, because you're going to try and maintain control over some of these things. You already see it. You know, you already see it in terms of some of the freedoms that are being chipped away here because they know they have to. You know, I don't want to say they're not stupid because, frankly, I think a lot of the powers that be are pretty stupid. But at the end of the day, they see the writing on the wall. Everyone feels it. Everyone knows it. You go out, people are not the same as they were 5 years ago. You know, it's a different environment. There's more hostility. There's more of kind of electrified, you know, here's one for you. So the crust of the Earth vibrates from what we can record through geometrical measures for the last 2,000 years at approximately 7.83 hertz. The human heart beats at 7.83 hertz. That gives you some good harmony, all right? Well, recently, the vibration of the crust of the Earth has jumped above 8. It's something like 8.17 or 8.27, something like that. I forget the exact number. But we're out of sync, Jim, and you see it everywhere. You see it in human behavior on the roads, in the stores. A lot of it's our society. But look at the conflict. Look at the proliferation of these shows, you know? Road wars, customer wars. I mean, all these things, people are losing it, Jim. And there's a scientific reason behind this that everyone feels, but very few people understand. And again, not to be a doomer and gloomer, because there's also spiritual enlightenment to be had here at the same time from the same dynamic. But the downside is it's only going to get more intense. We're in a 900-year cycle and it's only beginning.
Well, given this, you know, I think it was Ben Franklin that once said the two certainties in life are death and taxes. To that, I would add a third, inflation. So given the fact that we both see this inflation continuing, what would you be doing as an investor here? Because we're dealing with really upside down and volatile markets.
That's the most pertinent question. And it's a great question. And it's a difficult question to answer because I think the bulk of people don't necessarily want to hear the answer. The thought process that buy and hold stocks for 20 years is going to provide you retirement has been obliterated. Okay. It's just not going to be that way anymore. You need to be much more flexible, nimble, and involved in so many other things besides stocks. If you want to keep pace with inflation, frankly, you need to own some commodities. Frankly, you need to have the ability to be short bonds and long bonds. So I think short bond markets take a place like Japan. I mean, being short the JGB will be one way you'll be able to keep pace with inflation, even in the U.S. These are the things that I think, you know, individual investors are going to have to take advantage of to really keep pace with inflation in the future. And if you remember back to the 70s, what was one of the best investments back in the 70s? It wasn't stocks. Stocks went nowhere in the 70s. I mean, people forget. I mean, I'm old enough to remember some of the things that most people out there in this industry, you know, never experienced, which is a period where the stock market goes sideways. What good does that do you if you're a buy and hold investor for your retirement? It does no good. What was the big investment back in the 70s? CTAs. Commodity trading advisors, guys like me, are going to become more valuable in the future. And I don't say that because that's what I do. I said it because I really believe it. Because what's coming next is you're going to need to be flexible, way more diversified than ever. And it's not just stocks. You need commodities, especially food commodities. I mean, just so many markets out there that offer such great potential that I think currencies, I mean, you know, being able to trade every currency market in the world, being able to trade every stock market short, particularly for a while and then long again, because, you know, stocks will go up during this. It's inflation. Dollar down is good for stocks. So it's not like I'm a perma bear on stocks. I'm not. I just don't think it'll keep pace with inflation in terms of the returns. I think you need to enhance your returns through other means. And I think the futures markets provide the perfect way to do that. Now, having said that, it's difficult for an individual to do that. The average individual investor has no clue as to the mathematics involved in being a successful futures trader. Think you can put up 50 grand and trade futures? Come on, Jim, that's 50 bucks in gold. In one day, you can be wiped out if you buy enough contracts, right? There's a lot of math involved, and we've actually started doing boot camps. Futures trading boot camp. We have a futures trading boot camp that we offer now. And I did this just to try and help people. And sure, we make a few bucks on the side, but it's not like it's a high-priced product. It gives you a plethora of information. I would say that for most people, they probably not adequately capitalized to trade the futures market. I mean, some of these markets now at these high prices, the underlying value of the contracts are so huge that simple, small, and normal, if you will, as if anything is normal, but normal percentage changes on day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis are huge in their dollar value. And that's a big deal. So I really think that people should do a lot of research, find a good CTA that kind of, you know, is in sync with what you're thinking. But I think that's a place where people should have at least a portion of their money in the futures market in the future.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, as we close, speaking of that, tell people how they can find out more about the work that you do at Weldon Online and Weldon Live.
Sure. Well, the Weldon Live is our daily research product. We do 3 or 4 days a week. It's global macro in nature. So we have specific trading recommendations in foreign exchange, bonds, stocks, on all the range of commodities from precious and industrial metals to energy to agricultural products. So that's the research side of it. We're also doing the boot camp now. So the boot camp is available. If you come visit our website and contact us, we can give information on how to access that. And really something that I haven't done on your show and really haven't done much in the past is we're open to new investment. Our minimum is $1 million. And the reason it's $1 million is because I'm a very low risk guy. I want 0.4% to be my average per trade risk. Trying to get 0.4% on risk in terms of something like palladium or something like even coffee, let alone the DAX or Bitcoin or something. We trade the crypto futures. I think it's a great vehicle. It's very difficult. You know, that means I'm risking $4,000 a trade. Sometimes the average daily trading range is $4,000. So, you know, you have to be really careful and you have to really be aware of the math. But we're open to new investment right now. I'm a Series 3 registered CTA. I would also like to put out there, for real retail people, our new podcast too. Okay. It's called Money, Markets, and New Age Investing. We're going to talk about all these things and how to, you know, better position yourself to try and keep pace with what's coming next. That's Money, Markets, and New Age Investing.
All right. Well, listen, we'll talk to you once again. All the best.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us for this week's edition of Smart Macro is, as always, our Chief Investment Officer here at Financial Sense Wealth Management, Chris Poplava. So, Chris, when we spoke with you 2 weeks ago, you were talking about the weekly blowout jobs report that we got at the time, and saying that when you look at the underlying trends, the economy, corporate profits, and monetary policy, all of these are continuing to exert pressure on the outlook for the stock market. And of course, we did see stocks drop this week, anywhere from 2% to over 3% on the NASDAQ, depending on the index you're looking at. So pretty big drop off in the stock market. It looks like the narrative is certainly changing to align with what you told us 2 weeks ago. So let's start there. What is your outlook on the markets and the economy currently?
Well, Chris, I think part of what we've seen is this really strong repricing of Fed expectations, where, you know, the terminal rate was expected to be 5%. That's ratcheted up pretty significantly to nearly 5.5% just since we got the January data earlier this month. We also saw with that increase in Fed expectations, a bottom in the dollar. The dollar's rallied considerably this month. But the idea is that, you know, initially when we went into this year, the thought, or really the debate, was between hard or soft landing, meaning a deep recession or a mild one. But that has now changed to a third option, which is no landing, meaning we do not have a recession at all, mild or hard and severe. That the U.S. economy can have a basically continue to grow and have one of those essentially a growth cycle slowdown without a recession. And I really just think that likelihood is remote, in my opinion. I think what we're seeing is a lot of this delayed stimulus from the stimulus programs coming out of COVID. You know, in 21 was roughly mostly the same as coming directly to consumers by the federal government. And what we saw over the last 12 months or so, which Anna Wan, you've had on the program discussed from Bloomberg, is that we're now kind of seeing state stimulus, where states got a lot of the stimulus spending from the federal government. They held on to that, and they were kind of delayed in getting that into the hands of their of the consumer, which we are seeing. So we have that, and I think that plus a decent, you know, jobs market is keeping things afloat. But, you know, one of the things that when you go back and study the 70s was inflation was not a coincident indicator of the economy. It was a lagging. For a lot of the recessions that we saw in the 70s and early 80s, employment peaked in the middle of the recession, not before. So, you know, just because we have a strong jobs market right now does not negate that we could already be in recession. When you look at housing activity, when you look at manufacturing, all of these things are in deep recessionary territory. And the concern that I have is I don't think there's going to be really any significant relief when it comes to housing. You have the 30-year fixed rate mortgage right now, according to Bankrate, is at 6.94. That's not that far off from its all-time high that we saw, or at least over this cycle, which was around 7.2, 7.3. So it's still highly elevated. And because interest rates have gone back up and home prices have only come down marginally, when you look at the National Association of Realtors Housing Affordability Index, that sits at its lowest level ever. So housing is still not attractive, even though we are seeing some softness in certain regions, and we have seen interest rates come off their highs. That's still not enough, I think, Chris, to move the needle. So I don't see a turnaround in housing anytime soon. And as we saw from Home Depot's earnings this week, we're starting to see that in terms of home builders and in terms of home remodeling when we look at the earnings release from Home Depot recently.
Well, when we spoke with you at the end of 2021, you know, you were saying that prepare for some downside risks and volatility for the market for all of 2022. And we were defensively positioned heading into last year and keeping with that view. And then at the beginning of this year, in our forecast 2023 that we posted, the title of that was Turbulence and Volatility. So, you know, we're still sticking to this message that things are going to be choppy. There's going to be lots of turbulence. And like you said, starting off, you know, this debate between no landing, hard landing, soft landing. As Anna Wong had said, if we see no landing in the first half, and many other strategists saying this as well, then we're likely setting up for a crash landing in the second half, because that just means the Fed would have to raise rates even far faster and higher than if we were to see a soft landing. So I think probably the best situation that we could see in, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, base case that we should be expecting for this year is kind of a slow grind into a recession, maybe in the second half, not any runaway growth, inflation still being stickier, and the Fed keeping rates at a fairly restrictive level, probably more than what Wall Street anticipates.
You know, I think we're going to have a lot more clarity in terms of this debate if we're going to have even that third option of no landing at all in a week. So over the next week, we're going to get fresh data for February, which will really shed light if that strong January payroll, strong January retail sales was an anomaly, or if it's genuine, if we have some real robustness to the U.S. economy. Next week, we get the manufacturing ISM, the service ISM. We get fresh readings from the Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Survey for February. And at the end of the week, we're going to get the February payroll report. So that will be really big in terms of, you know, telling where we are in terms of this economy. Was that just a mirage that we saw in January where, you know, it's just a blip, but the trend remains down? Or are we seeing some stability and some, you know, near-term improvement? So I think this debate, Chris, will really be resolved in the next week because I do believe those big reports, manufacturing, ISM, and payrolls will really shed light in terms of what happened. Now, you know, one key thing to point out, Chris, and this is also something when you go back and study the 70s, which was kind of an issue, was that, you know, people weren't used to high rates of inflation, whether that be the consumer or businesses. And there's the tendency to focus on nominal economic activity, nominal prices, not real prices. And when you look at nominal versus real spending, essentially real retail sales peaked in March of 21. They came down, and ever since roughly June, July of 21, real retail sales have been absolutely flat. We are talking zero growth in consumer retail spending, which is, you know, 2/3 of the economy. since then. It's all been inflationary. So we're consuming the same quantity of services and goods since for the last 2 years. We're just paying more for it. So yes, we're on the top line. We are seeing record spending on nominal retail sales. But when you factor out inflation, there's been no growth at all over the last 2 years in retail spending.
Yeah, I remember in 2021 and 2022, you know, there's these reports coming out in the mainstream news headlines about retail sales or various types of spending figures coming out at all-time highs, showing that the consumer was spending just fine. And then, you know, you dig into the details and you'd find out, oh, well, actually, that's because gas prices went up a whole bunch. And so, or, you know, prices had gone up. So it wasn't actually, like you're saying, it wasn't in real terms. It was either flat or even negative. But, you know, that's the illusion that's created by high inflation sometimes. And you really have to dig in and kind of peer through some of that stuff to figure out what's going on. So that's what you're saying right now, is that when you back out inflation, consumer spending is flat.
That's correct, Chris. And, you know, sometimes the data can diverge from each other, particularly at turning points. One of the areas that we see that is when it comes to employment. So we have two surveys. We have the non-farm payrolls, which does have some modeling adjustments in there, and that's looking at it from the employer perspective. But we also have the household survey by the BLS, and that's looking from the employee perspective. And there's some really key important changes. For example, if Chris, in the BLS, they basically call hundreds of thousands of households every month and ask, are you working? So if you received a call and you are working two jobs, well, they just look at you. You are not unemployed. You are working. So they look at that as one job. But now look at it the other way. Let's say that they contact your two employers and they give the number of employees that they have, full-time or part-time. That looks like you're basically double counting. You're counted twice versus looking at the household survey. So, you know, just as I mentioned, Chris, last 2 years, we've seen a real divergence between nominal and inflation-adjusted retail sales. We kind of see that when we look at payroll counts, whether you're looking from the employer or employee perspective. And another way that I kind of like looking at it, kind of comparing data to see what makes sense, is looking at paychecks. Paychecks does payroll for hundreds of thousands of small businesses across the country, and their data is not revised. I mean, it's true bean counting, and their data shows that their employment index is down from year ago levels. So they're showing actual job declines in terms of payroll count versus, you know, what you're seeing from the non-farm payrolls, which are showing growth in jobs. So to me, Chris, you know, at turning points, the data can get real murky, where some data points in one direction and other data points in the other, in the opposite direction. And I think to me, that's just another sign that we've met an inflection point in the economy. And, you know, while we were dealing with growth ever since late 2020, I think the U.S. economy is slipping into a recession. Whether we're in one, you know, right now or not, we'll only know with hindsight. But I really push back against the idea that we're going to skirt a recession altogether.
Yeah. And here's another thing, too, is, you know, at the State of the Union speech weeks back, Biden was touting the fact that we're seeing a 50-year low in the unemployment number. And then also Janet Yellen at the Treasury, previously at the Fed, talking about how, you know, we've never seen a recession when unemployment levels are these low. But in the context of turning points, I mean, that's basically showing you that at this point, unemployment can't really go much lower than where it's at, and it's likely to pick up. And that's something that we've seen prior to nearly every recession. So I think Janet Yellen, I'm not sure what she's looking at, if she's just trying to stick to a narrative. Of course, you know, every president is going to tout their own data, so that's not surprising. But one thing that Anna Wong had said that aligns with this view, again, chief U.S. economist at Bloomberg, when we spoke with her recently, was that those layoff announcements that we saw really pick up in the tech sector and now are starting to spill over into other sectors, those won't actually take effect, she said, until starting next month in March. So we should start to see those layoffs take place and get implemented in March which would then start to get reflected in the initial claims, which have been low. And it's been causing a lot of confusion with people saying, hey, what's with all these layoff announcements and yet layoff and then initial jobless claims aren't going anywhere, showing the job market is strong. It sounds like from Anna Wong's viewpoint and outlook in the context of what we're discussing today, that we are getting close to that pretty big turning point in the jobs market. And again, their data is still lining up for very high odds for a recession in the second half of this year. And as we know, the stock market typically discounts future economic activity by anywhere from what, isn't like six to nine months?
Yes, on average, the market typically peaks 6 to 9 months in advance of that. Obviously, the market peaked in January 21, a year ago. Again, that just speaks to how odd and peculiar the cycle is. There's just so many different things with the crazy amount of stimulus being spent, giving money to consumers and households that were working. I understand, giving money to people who are unemployed, but we gave money to people who even were still working, which is just crazy. So I think we had a lot of excess that we threw at the economy that really is kind of, clouding the data and people's judgments. And just, another sign, Chris, of how insane the cycle has been. The Federal Reserve raises interest rates, and the Fed, just like any other bank, has assets and liabilities. Its assets are all the treasuries and mortgage-backed securities it purchased, which it earns interest on, and it remits that interest to the U.S. Treasury. But the Fed also has liabilities that it pays interest on. And for the last decade, the net interest on its assets exceeded the interest it was paying on its liabilities, which allowed them to give money to the Treasury and helped lower the budget deficit. But right now, with the Federal Reserve raising rates and it's paying a higher short-term rate on its liabilities, the Federal Reserve, a lot of their assets, Chris, because they're shedding, they're not buying assets. Their assets they purchased, the treasuries and mortgage-backed securities they purchased years ago, were when interest rates were near 0%. So we're getting to this case, Chris, where we have this crazy situation where right now we have negative interest remittance to the Treasury, which is to the tune of negative $36 billion. So the Federal Reserve is quickly digging itself into a hole, and it's basically looking at this as negative equity on their balance sheet. But, when we about the end of January, Chris, that was running around negative $20 billion. Now we're looking at negative $36 billion. I mean, that's up 50% in negative earnings remittance to the Treasury in just 1 month. And the Fed is still likely raising interest rates. So you can just imagine how backwards the situation is, where essentially the Fed is, in a negative situation. And same thing when it comes to the U.S. Treasury. When we closed out last year, the Treasury was paying roughly, I think, around $800 billion in interest. And as more and more U.S. debt is maturing and being replaced by new debt at higher interest rates, I think, Chris, on a 12-month basis before the end of the year, the U.S. Treasury will be paying over $1 trillion in interest. So there is, in my opinion, a limit to how high interest rates can go before you break the U.S. Treasury, essentially kind of break the Federal Reserve, at least at the balance sheet level. They do have their accounting gimmicks. But, look at the housing market. How in the world is housing going to turn around when you've got a 30-year fixed rate mortgage near 7% and prices not that far off their all-time high? So, I agree with Anna Wong. I really push back that we're going to skirt a recession. So what that means at some point, Chris, we're going to have to see earnings revisions for stocks significantly reduced and lowered from here in that, kind of bullish outlook really revised lower by the analyst consensus.
Well, Chris, as we wrap things up, as we've been speaking with you every 2 weeks on the Smart Macro segment here, you've been saying really for past couple months that you view this as a bear market rally and that we were still cautious and defensive on the outlook. Again, our view in the very beginning of this year, our forecast for 2023 is turbulence and volatility, still sticking with that cautious theme that we stuck with at late 2021 all the way through 2022. And that has been the right way to position around this at this point. What is it we're doing, and what are some of the ways in which you're telling our clients and investors on how to navigate the market moving forward?
Well, Chris, when we look at our portfolios, we are active managers, so we can have a minimum risk level, a neutral level compared to our benchmarks, or an aggressive level. And we have not been at an aggressive level, gosh, I think in 2 years. So we've really reduced our exposure to the market. Sometimes, you know, when we saw the October low, late October, early November, we did put money back to work to kind of play a bear market rally. You know, at that point, we were at minimum risk levels. We wanted to get back to neutral at least and participate. But over the last month, Chris, we have been shedding our exposure to the stock market, reducing our risk and kind of getting back from a neutral level to a, you know, on our way towards eventually a minimum, maximum defensive position. Because I really, truly believe that this is just a bear market rally and that we have more pain to go. So our plan is to continue to hide in the bunker, which that bunker looks pretty nice, Chris, when you've got short-term treasuries and money markets paying nearly 5% with zero volatility. So, you know, that's kind of what we're doing right now. We're just waiting for the opportunity to basically put money back to work.
All right. And as you've been saying all along, I mean, when you look at it, the Fed is still raising rates. They're still engaged in quantitative tightening. We're still seeing the leading economic indicators declining and flagging very high odds for recession. So, I mean, it just across the board, when you look at the primary drivers behind the market, those things are all giving you a very defensive and cautious view on the market. That's the message that we've been sticking with ever since late 2021 when markets peaked. So still sticking with that message. And at this point now, it's just to track kind of what we see with the LEIs and a number of the other things that we discuss regularly on this segment, as well as through your weekly investment videos. So I do want to make sure that all of you listening, if you don't already, I would highly encourage you to check out the YouTube videos that we post nearly every week, where we have a huddle of our team. And Chris Poplav, our CIO here, does a review of all the different charts and indicators that we follow, typically zeroing in on what is the most important thing right now for the outlook. So it's always a pleasure to speak with you to get an update on your outlook. And we definitely look forward to speaking with you another 2 weeks.
Look forward to it, Chris.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939, or go to financialsense.com and click where it says contact us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.